Hello. This is the part where you clap hands, by the way. Thank you very much. And also for these three gentlemen. Okay, not funny. Guys, when Winston asked me to introduce the discussion tonight about 50 minutes ago, I realized that I hate Winston for doing that, which is a bad thing because I need to introduce him. So it's not smart play from his side. But what I would like to tell you, though, is that we're talking on morality tonight. And whenever there's a discussion going on in a culture in South Africa where we're not that used to public discussion, people or emotions tend to get heated. Now, I want to urge you that whilst we have a discussion on morality and God, it's very important that the crowd remains moral. This is crucial. I mean, imagine the headlines in the newspaper about saying five people killed at morality discussion, Eusebius still at large. I mean, that's not on. And I'm talking to all of you guys when I say this. Christians, those of you out there, try and keep your amens and hallelujahs till Sunday. That's important. And that's not all. I mean, the atheists, to shout out praise Dawkins, that's just weird. Don't do that. And agnostics, well, I suppose you guys are confused enough, so I'm not going to confuse you any further. But in my experience, we've had the most problems with deists in the past. If you don't know what a deist is, it's the annoying guy tonight. I promise you. So if you're a deist, please just go sit in the back and relax. So guys, let's try and be challenged tonight with this discussion. If you're a Christian, allow Eusebius to challenge you. If you're a skeptic, allow John to challenge you. And as a spectator, here's a crucial thing. Watch and listen and try and keep your emotions at bay. So that's the first thing I want to say. And also, just to level the playing field a little bit, there's a lot of people that came in from Pretoria, and a lot of Christians, actually, that came in from Pretoria for this discussion tonight and has lost their faith due to the incredible traffic in Johannesburg. Now, that obviously gives Eusebius a distinct advantage in the Pretoria contingent of tonight's discussion. But the Johannesburg section has lately refound their faith because it seems like the Lions are winning some rugby games again. So John definitely have the advantage with the Johannesburg side. I promise this debate is going to be more sophisticated when I get off the stage. The other thing that I need to say very quickly is the sponsors for tonight. The Student Christian Organization of WITS, thank you so much for your help. WITS University for allowing us to have this discussion tonight. We thank you guys. And then three other ministries, RZIM, which stands for Ravi Zacharias International Ministry, and our moderator tonight, Winston, is a part of that ministry. Dialoog, you can woohoo him if you want to. But you know what, I'm going to introduce him now, then you can woohoo. Dialoog is the other ministry that's involved with tonight, and Antwoord Ministry, which should not be confused with the band, the Antwoord. So that's important. Whilst I'm talking about those last two ministries, Dialoog and Antwoord, if you would like a recording of tonight's discussion, just go to www.dialoog.co.za or www.antwoord.org.za. That's basically the first thing you want to write down in tonight's discussion. Now, because crowds don't behave themselves, technology has helped us with a hashtag thing that we're going to do. So if you want to ask questions, the hashtag is hashtag, believe it or not, GMWITS. GM as in the cricket brand, but more specifically, God Morality WITS. All right. And that's important. So if you want to send your questions, we're gonna filter those questions and give it to Winston to do that. So please, Winston will remind you again. If he doesn't, then hashtag GM Witz. And then the last thing I want to say is that Winston is going to be the moderator. There's a lot of intelligent people here with long CVs, so I'm not going to say much about Winston, apart from the fact that he is a part of RZIM, and he recently studied an honors degree at Oxford University, meaning that all three of these people has had a stint at Oxford University. And because of that fact, I'm going to get off the stage now so that it can remain that this stage is an Oxford-only zone. Ladies and gentlemen, Winston Mashua.
Thank you. And I, in turn, will ask, would you please give a round of applause to Johan for that introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the great discussion at the Great Hall. God and morality. Is there a question, a connection? We know there's a question already, but we need to make the link. Excuse me for that. Ladies and gentlemen, I am very, very, very pleased to be here, honored to be amongst these. You have not come to listen to me speak, and so what I will do is do that to the minimum. You've come to hear these two great thinkers speak. Your job is to listen. If you finish your job first, please do let me know as the moderator so I can make sure the discussion keeps going. But we've already had a lesson in how we should behave. Since this is a discussion on morality, take it that everybody will behave and we'll give the two thinkers an opportunity to express their thoughts. But I do want to introduce them to us tonight. And the way it's going to work is I'll introduce them. And what I will do then is I'll ask a few probing questions to frame the question tonight so that they can tell us about their positions, their respective positions, and we'll have some engagements on that topic. And in the end, what we will do is we will take some of your questions that you've sent through to Twitter. Remember the hashtag CapM, God Morality, and Cap the W in Vits. So GM Vits. Without further ado, let me introduce you. These men both need no introductions, so if you want to read their long bios, which is enough to be a thesis on their own, please go to their respective websites and on the internet. A lot's been said about them, but I've just picked up what is out of interest tonight for us. And I'll start with Professor John Lennox. Professor John Lennox is a professor of mathematics at the University of Oxford. He's a fellow in mathematics and the philosophy of science at Oxford. He's a lecturer at Wycliffe Hall, Oxford University, and also at the Oxford Center for Christian Apologetics. He has written extensively about the relationship between science and Christianity, as well as about new atheism. In fact, on that last note, he has debated the likes of Richard Dawkins several times, Peter Singer, as well as the late Christopher Hitchens. Ladies and gentlemen, please, will you give a round of applause to Professor John Lennox tonight. And on my right, another man who needs no introduction, so I'll say a few things that are interesting for us here tonight about him. Eusebius McKeyser is an associate at the Wits Center for Ethics in the Philosophy Department. He's lectured philosophy in South Africa and in England. He did his master's thesis on moral objectivity. He's a talk radio host on Power FM. He's written two books, A Bantu in My Bathroom and Can I Vote the DA, to which I'm still trying to get an answer from him. He's also a former World Masters debate champion. Please, will you put your hands together for Eusebius McKeyser? So like I said, tonight we're discussing God and morality and asking the question, is there a connection? So what I'm going to do first is I will start with you, John, and ask two questions. The first one is, as a professor, is it true that a professor, by definition, is someone who speaks in someone else's sleep? Or is it that fact that 99% of professors give the rest a bad name?
It's only a mathematics professor who specializes in lecturing on other people's sleep, yes.
Thank you. John, our interest tonight is to ask the question, what is your position on the existence of God, and how did you arrive at that conclusion?
Well, let me first say, ladies and gentlemen, what a delight it is to be in Wits University. When I first heard I was to have a discussion with Eusebius, I thought of an ancient bishop of Caesarea who was one of the towering intellectuals of the 3rd century. So I'm delighted that he's not come back from the 3rd century, but from the 21st, and is one of the people whom I'm delighted to hear is stimulating and probing his listeners to think. So we're very much on the same score there. So thank you very much for inviting me. I'm delighted to have such a worthy conversation partner, and I'm much looking forward to the discussion. Now, you ask me why I believe in God. And everybody's got a biography, and I'm from Northern Ireland. My parents were Christian, but they were not sectarian, which is very remarkable. My father employed equally across the Catholic-Protestant divide, got bombed for it. And one of the things I learned from my parents was this basic principle that all human beings are of equal value because they're made in the image of God. I saw from the start Christianity in a living form. And the interesting thing, it was not anti-intellectual, it was the exact opposite. It was expansive, it was open. It was my parents that first taught me and encouraged me to critically reflect on what I believed. Indeed, when I was 13, my dad handed me the Communist Manifesto. And he said, have you ever read this? And I said, no. Well, he said, you better, because you need to get to know what other people think. So, second thing about my parents was they allowed me to think. And those are precious gifts. And so I first started seeing Christianity lived by people who were credible intellectually, morally. And of course, later on as I grew, I investigated my faith, because my parents had taught me to do that, to see was there real rational as distinct from empirical underpinning. I became a mathematician and a scientist, and I remember discovering that my field of contemporary science owes its birth to Christianity. C.S. Lewis put it this way, men became scientific because they expected law and nature, and they expected law and nature because they believed in a lawgiver. That opened up a whole new world. That the basic faith of a scientist, as Einstein put it, is in the rational intelligibility of the universe, and the grounding of that for them, for Galileo, Kepler, Newton, and so on, was the fact that the universe had been created by a rational God. So, you see, I'm not ashamed of being a scientist and a Christian, because arguably Christianity gave me my subject. Now, in later years, I've investigated the whole question of rational intelligibility. Because, you see, I've come to the situation now where I believe that there's only superficial conflict between belief in God and science and deep concord. And there's only superficial concord between atheism and science, but deep conflict. And I'm coming rapidly to the conclusion that atheism and science don't mix at all, for the very simple reason that atheism undermines the very rationality we need to do science. But then, of course, in the moral sphere, which we're going to come to, the existence of objective moral values has always interested me. The fact that all around the world we have this common pool of morality, that's been noticed for a long time. And it was J.L. Mackey, who's very familiar, I think, to my discussion partner here in Oxford, and he was an atheist. He said that, you know, there is a pathway from the existence of objective morals to belief in God. Putting it another way, I think it's perfectly consistent not only to regard God as the ultimate grounding of rationality, but also as the ultimate, and I stress that word, grounding of morality. There is a reason why we all have very similar moral attitudes. For me, that is, to go back to my parents again, the fact that we're made in the image of God. Now, pragmatically, I've spent my life exposing my faith in God to its critical opposites. That has taken me particularly to East Germany during the Cold War, traveling there for 26 years, and then since 1989, spending a great deal of time in Russia, because I was interested in querying whether or not my belief in God was a product of Irish genetics. And that's always been thrown at me, and I may get it thrown at me tonight, but we'll see what happens when it is. The fact is, the more I've exposed my faith in God to its opposite, the more I've found it confirmed, because it deals with the big questions. Now, one of them, of course, is the moral impact of atheism when it's imposed on a nation. And how many Russian academics have said to me this: we thought we could get rid of God and retain a value for human beings, and we discovered too late that we couldn't. And it seems to me that is something that is highly non-trivial, because it is a massive part of 20th century history. And of course, Nietzsche got it dead right. He saw exactly what would happen when people got rid of God and thought they could retain a value for humans. And he said, you can't. And he would mock at the soft atheism of today that tries to retain the values of a Western liberal democracy and not of God. And he would say, wait and see what happens to that. But then there's more evidence you asked before, Winston. You see, it now comes, we're going through various disciplines, science, ethics, and philosophy, and now I come to ancient history. Because you see, ladies and gentlemen, I sit as a Christian. Christianity is not a mere philosophy. It's geared into history, and it's geared into experience. So ancient history becomes enormously important for me. The ancient history of documents leading to a confidence in the authenticity of the New Testament record. But not only that, narrowing it, the ancient history and its helpfulness in getting to grips with the central claim of Christianity, which is that Jesus Christ rose from the dead the third day. That's why I sit here as a Christian, because I believe that this is evidence-based in terms of history. But not only in terms of history, because if this claim is true, then it means, of course, logically, that Christ is still alive. And he made certain claims when he was on earth. For instance, he claimed that if people trusted him, they could receive forgiveness and a new life that would enable them to battle against all the mess that we battle against in our own lives and bring them peace and hope. Now, this is empirical. Does it actually work? And one of my biggest grounds for believing in God, and of course now I want to make precise the God I believe in, he's not the God of the gaps who disappears when you do a bit of science. This is the God of the whole show, who invented the whole universe, the bits of it that we understand and the bits we don't understand, the whole show. And it seems to me extremely important here that my faith is based on historical facts, my experiences as a scientist, but above all, in the difference faith in Christ and God makes to my daily life. I've been married for 46 years. And I would owe the success of that relationship and many other relationships in life to the fact that it's got a focal point. It's got a transcendent point outside ourselves. Now, I've seen far too many times, well, not far too many times, not enough times, people being transformed from people who have no meaning in life, have no purpose in life. Some of them have been saved from suicide by coming to faith in God. It has transformed alcohol dependence into peace, happiness, and a bit of prosperity. And so for me, the evidence that there is a God and that he's real and it is possible to have a relationship with him comes cumulatively from every conceivable direction. And there are some very big things in there. All of us face the problem of pain and suffering. I have no simplistic answers to it. It's the hardest question I face. And yet, I believe there's a way in through the death and resurrection of Christ that's not open to atheism. Atheism, of course, thinks it solved the problem by saying that's the way the universe is. But I notice it leaves the suffering and the pain, but it removes all hope. And so I sit here as a convinced believer in God, having spent my entire life from I was essentially a boy, asking the big questions, being self-critical as I can. One of the leitmotifs of my attitude to myself comes from Richard Feynman, the Nobel Prize winner, who says, above all, be critical of yourself because you're the easiest person for yourself to deceive. So, ladies and gentlemen, those are one or two reasons for my believing in God.
Thank you so much, Professor. Eusebius, can we hear an amen from you? The same question, Eusebius. What is your position regarding the existence of God, and how, most importantly, did you arrive at that conclusion?
Thank you, Winston. Firstly, good evening to everyone, and thank you so much for being here. It really is an absolute privilege to have people turn out thinking it's worth coming to listen to a discussion between myself and John, and I really do appreciate that. Also, how's it to the people watching on YouTube tomorrow? And I'd like to thank the organizers for putting this together. An important reason why I accepted it was, firstly, I'm fascinated by Christians like John who self-examine and who think making your religious beliefs intelligible and justified is a burden they're willing to not only take on, but they think they can discharge. So it really is a privilege for me to be in conversation with you. And then finally to Winston, he's the one who first approached me. I want to upfront also say thank you to him. Absolutely fantastic, a great mind himself. He's been on my radio show several times. He's a near-perfect human being. He's only got two weaknesses. The one is that he's Christian. And the second, like the groom on last week's Our Perfect Wedding, he's heterosexual. How did I... Firstly, to answer your question, then I'll describe how I got to it, which is a very different biography to that of Professor Lennox. I do not believe in the proposition God exists. I describe myself as an atheist. I fight with good friends like philosopher Jacques Rousseau, who's here tonight, whether I should rather properly describe myself for philosophical and practical reasons as atheist. But that's a discussion I will bracket out for now. The important thing is I do not believe the claim God exists is a true claim. I was born into a family of Catholic adults. I had Catholicism imposed on me, much as many of you had Christianity imposed on you. So I wasn't a Catholic child who chose through reflection at the age of 13 to become an altar boy in Grahamstown at St. Mary's Catholic Church. That was just a fact of my family life. And so it continued. Embarrassment at the altar. I never went back to continue being an altar boy. I later did go through the first Holy Communion. I think I was in matric by then. And then the most marvelous thing happened. I went to Rhodes University where leaders drink and they choose really awesome subjects like philosophy. And what philosophy has taught me, which has fundamentally influenced who I am as a person, it's actually changed my character in the same way in which John's parents have had such a profound influence on his attitude towards his intellectual projects and personal beliefs, is that philosophy has taught me that evidence matters in your belief system. It's not to say, and John and I can both cite them and we'll agree on them, that there aren't examples of great Christian philosophers. I mean, indeed, even here in South Africa, one of my favorite lecturers, in case the others are watching on YouTube, was Francis Williamson at Rhodes University, who was deeply committed to his Catholicism. But broadly, what I've taken from my studies over the years in analytic philosophy is that it's a good thing, if you are interested in living the examined life, to have beliefs that track the evidence. And if they don't, then you have beliefs that are not warranted, that are unjustified, or that are simply false. And then I started examining my Catholicism that was imposed on me. And I realized that there isn't a shred of compelling evidence in favor of the proposition God exists. What I found instead, when I looked at my friends, including my philosophy friends, who remained committed to their Catholicism or their Christianity more broadly, like John, is that the kinds of arguments they provided did not meet the good standards that I had been taught by so many great epistemology lecturers that have taught me in philosophy. So I've heard what John said from my friends who are philosophers and Christian. I've heard descriptions about the amazing intelligibility of the universe, the awe that the probabilities are so incredibly low that this universe had to happen. I've heard the amazing thing about ultimate hope, what a difference it can make to save a marriage if you let God into it. I've heard all of that, but it never satisfied me, because the simple question is that the appropriate kind of evidence? And of course the answer is no, because what it does give you is pragmatism, in the same way in which taking ecstasy may really, really make you feel cool if you've gone through a painful journey. I'm not sure if it follows that it is a good thing to be addicted to ecstasy. So a description from my friends who are Christian about the functional purpose that this belief in God has played has never satisfied me as a philosopher, because it is not the sort of justification that tells me there's evidence, like there's evidence of this bottle in front of me that can be observed, that can be experienced, that can be verified, that can be described in a manner that is open to someone who is skeptical at the outset of their dialogue. I've never come across that. What I've heard from folks who are Christian, whether they are ordinary folks or philosophers of science or mathematicians, I heard the same when John was in a beautiful conversation with my ex-colleague John Matham on Cape Talk last week, is almost ultimately, and I'll stop in a minute or two, that's been a nice provocative end to my opening remarks, almost an appeal to the beauty of the structure in the universe, plus high improbabilities that this universe had to come about. But it doesn't follow from that that you can infer that God exists. Furthermore, Winston, even if you could conclude that only a natural, supernatural being can account for what scientists can't account for in terms of why the Big Bang had to happen, and I don't think atheists can, which is why John and I, as we discovered over early dinner, have a lot in common in his critique of atheist scientists, but his Christian commitments do not follow from the shortcomings of science in not being able to account for why this universe had to come about. And that's something for me, as someone who wants to be, as we say in philosophy, but the jargon is unimportant, who wants to be a good epistemic agent, which just means someone who likes beliefs that are proportionate to the evidence. There's no evidence for that proposition. And that's why I simply could not get myself to commit to the statement, God actually exists. By contrast, two things. I'm very happy to not be certain at all about the origins of the universe. It is, for those of you who are nerdish about the distinction between agnostics and atheists, the very reason why I'm comfortable being an agnostic. I'm happy for clever people like John to be part of research projects at Oxford to try and make sense of whether a complete scientific account of the origins of the universe is possible, or whether indeed there can be a more satisfying set of evidence statements to people like myself who want empirical proof, for example, that God actually exists. But in the meantime, I don't need to take a view on the proposition God exists. But I am very firm, and this is where the idea that agnosticism is fence-sitting betrays a lack of education, I'm sad to say, doesn't mean that I don't have a view that I'm scared to commit. I am comfortable with not committing to a proposition about which there isn't clear enough evidence. Now, let me say a final thing about that. Even if it follows that it is a fair inference that a supernatural being has to account for the origins of the universe and therefore must exist, even if that's true, we still haven't got to your Christian God, I'm afraid, because the Christian God comes with bells and whistles, like being all-loving, but not being able to help the flu that I have currently, not intervening with TB Joshua's building collapsing. So the most you get is a supernatural being. You do not even get the Christian God. So the Christian has an additional burden. If you want to rely on biology and high improbabilities to infer a supernatural being, the most you've got is the idea of a deity. We're still a long way away from the Christian God. And for those reasons, it would be utterly irresponsible of me, Winston, to be a Christian.
Well, thank you very much. Eusebius, am I correct in saying that, not to be reductionist here, but you've surveyed the evidence for the existence as well as the evidence for the non-existence of God, and you have found that not compelling to make a commitment to either one position?
Yes.
All right.
That's perfect.
Thank you very much. My question then to you, Professor John, is that you've heard Eusebius's position. Where exactly, just for us here, do you disagree with him, and could you help us follow?
I disagree with him at many points. I mean, it's very interesting to compare our backgrounds, and the forcing of Catholicism on people undoubtedly plays a role on antipathy sometimes to religion. But I'm going to leave that aside, because I do so much approve of your point that evidence matters. I'm only interested in evidence-based faith. And you made the point that you haven't met arguments that don't meet the good standards. And you talked about probabilities. I never mentioned probabilities, actually. They weren't part of my argument. Because actually, I think the probability arguments are a little bit suspect. I mean, you and I are highly improbable, but we exist. Or at least I hope you believe you exist. So arguments from probabilities are a little bit weak. But I was very interested in your describing the bottle. You see, the bottle is visible and it's full of water. And you haven't had any evidence like that, but I actually gave you some. If I see a home that's been destroyed by a row of vodka bottles, and the person trusts Christ that those vodka bottles are turned into mineral water, I think something real has happened, as real as your perception of that bottle. And I think that is hard evidence of the empirical kind, which is why I mentioned it. Now, I would want to say, I use the word cumulative. Let me bring it out again. I think since belief in God is not belief in a theory, it's belief in a person. And our response to persons is much more complex, much deeper, much more sophisticated, and we use all kinds of arguments. So it seems to me that I would accept your bottle, but I think I can give you many examples that go along with it. But you made a very interesting concession in the middle there. You say Christianity doesn't account for the shortcomings of science. That's not the way I look at it at all. Because that seems to me to be part of the intellectual fog that surrounds this whole debate, that science explains and Christianity explains where science leaves off, so to speak. That's the God of the gaps, and no intelligent Christian or monotheist believes in the God of the gaps. I can't explain it, therefore God did it. And I think one of the very big mistakes that Stephen Hawking makes lurks exactly here. You've got to choose between God and science. He's got two problems. He's got a problem with God. He thinks of God as a kind of Greek god of thunder that disappears with a little bit more science. But I don't believe in a God like that. Neither did Newton. And when he discovered the law of gravity, he didn't say, I've got a law of gravity, I've got the science, I don't need God. No. He said, what a brilliant God that did it that way. Because he doesn't regard God as the same kind of explanation that science gives. And I may be wrong, but what I got out of that statement was, you appear to do that. Secondly, the profound mistake, the second one that Hawking makes and Dawkins and so on, they fail to distinguish mechanism and agency, or law, mechanism, and agency. And they're asking us to choose between God and science. It's like me asking you to choose between Henry Ford and the law of internal combustion as the explanation for a motor car. You see, what I think the God question, the God answer, so to speak, is the ground of all our rationality. Now, I'd love to hear you tell me why you trust your own rationality, because I notice you're a very rational man.
Why, thank you.
So what's the basis of your faith in your own rationality?
Well, I've heard you, obviously I've stalked you on YouTube, trying very hard, John, I must say, to force some of your interlocutors to think that there is a salient way in which faith, which as it appears in religious thought, is perfectly similar to trust in one's rationality, or trust, for example, that you can eliminate skepticism about the reality of this bottle. And with the deepest intellectual respect, I think that you're being very naughty there, because some of the philosophical skepticism in metaphysics, I'll translate it into English in a second, is not of the same kind as the nature of some of the evidence insensitive ways in which you describe to us how your belief in God has come about. So I want to pry that apart. I'm going to do that in a second. The other thing you do that I think you must stop imposing on poor Dawkins, and you do it effectively because Dawkins rightly deserves you to do this to him. But this is where Dawkins and I depart. I'm perfectly comfortable with the idea, and perhaps it's because I'm a humanities student, not a scientist. I'm perfectly comfortable with the fact that science can give us a mechanistic account at best, for example, the theory of evolution, of how we have evolved after the Big Bang has happened, but that it can never, and I've seen you effectively asking him this question, it hasn't as yet given an answer why the Big Bang had to happen at all, why did there have to be life, why did the universe have to come about. But what you then do, which is, from an argumentation point of view, to ascribe to your interlocutors what they are not saying, is that they are setting up this dichotomy between your God and a mechanistic account of human evolution.
No,
that is not true. That is not true. So what I can accept, for example, is the mechanistic account while remaining utterly agnostic to the mystery of why this thing called the Big Bang had to happen. You take on board a bigger evidential burden by coming up with an hypothesis without evidence, which I still await, and that hypothesis includes not just the concept of a supernatural being, but one that does amazing things inconsistent with your work as a scientist, like turning water into wine. Now, from a point of view of methodology in science, if we apply the idea that the simplest explanation is the best, then I'm afraid your atheistic scientists are no better wicked here. But of course, us agnostics are even better because we're comfortable with not being able to account for how this mechanistic process started off that Dawkins keeps banging on about. But you want to extract the Christian God from the dissatisfaction of not being able to account for the origins of the universe.
Incorrect.
That is not evidence. That
Absolute,
is not an argument. That is assertion.
False. That's incorrect. Yeah. It's okay. Oh, keep going.
Well,
yes.
I could feel the audience appreciating the argument, so I really don't mind John intervening at that point. But to answer your last question, John, more directly about faith in rationality, I mean, here I really don't think we must bore the audience too much with technical philosophy, but the sense in which I can give an account of why it's a justified belief to believe that there's a bottle here cannot be described as a leap of faith in the same way in which believing that God can convert water into wine is a leap of faith in the sense of being evidence insensitive. Because there are processes in science that John is committed to as a scientist that he uses in peer-reviewed work to test the quality of fellow academics in the scientific community's permissibility into a journal that is top class. And those methods are methods of falsification, verification, observation. So if those are the standards that he imposes routinely when he wears his hat as a scientist, it's rather bizarre to me that they're absent in his acceptance that I can turn this water into a bottle of Four Cousins.
Well, that was a subtle change. I didn't talk about water into wine. I talked about vodka into water. And you missed, therefore, entirely the point. That was a bit of evidence on the empirical level that God can change people. Now, I want to take up several of these points. You said, without a shred of evidence, I assert a God behind the rationality of the universe. Okay, let's deny the existence of God. And I often have this conversation with my colleagues. What do you do science with? They say, my brain. The cuter ones say, because they don't believe in mind. My brain. I say, what is your brain? Well, they say, the short story is, the brain is the end product of a mindless, unguided process. Oh, I say, and you trust it. That, to my mind, is an absurdity. Now, Thomas Nagel has just written a book, which you're probably aware of, Mind and Cosmos, Why the Neo-Darwinian View of the World is Almost Certainly False. And he has pointed out, much to the consternation of the new atheists, that we've been brilliant in reductionist scientists in science because we've left out the mind that's doing the science. And he makes the point, and it has hit cyberspace like a nuclear bomb, that if the Darwinian account were right, we'd never know it because it undermines rationality. Now, this is something that goes back a long way. So when you say there's not a shred of evidence, one of the way of testing hypotheses is to deny them and see what they lead to. And I would want to contend on this, the rational intelligibility of the universe, that it's atheism that leads to nonsense. In other words, what I'm doing is not establishing a mathematical proof, but an inference to the best explanation. One more point I want to address. You said that talking about science and rational intelligibility doesn't get us to the Christian God. Absolutely right. The New Testament concedes that. And that's why I said, when it comes to the God of the Bible, I have evidence from ancient history, from experience, and so on. I agree with you entirely that we don't get to the Bible. Now, the final point on the water into wine, which is now mentioned twice, and Richard Dawkins mentioned to me, he said, I know the sort of God John Lennox believes in. He turned water into wine. And I'm afraid it was slightly frivolous, but I'd make the point again. I said, Richard, you know, if Jesus is the Logos, the Son of God that created the universe, then he created water. So perhaps making it into wine wasn't a big deal after all.
Eusebius, let me ask for your final closing thoughts on this, because we got to move on and say something about morality.
Okay, yeah. So just a couple...
This is fascinating indeed.
And the morality one, I'm very keen to get to, because you will discover that John and I share a view on morality that's quite interesting. But just some final remarks on this. We don't have time to go into it. It's not the heart of today's conversation. And John generously has invited me to continue engaging in beyond this forum, and I will. I still think that there is a lot more work argumentatively that John needs to do to be compelling on this point, that me trusting my brain and my rationality is an act of faith. I think the use of faith there... Yeah, this is a House of Commons, apparently. Of course, the use of faith there, John, on your part, is an equivocation on faith. There's faith as in belief in the teeth of the evidence, without looking for evidence, where you just believe as a matter of trust. Nje, you might say in South Africa. That's one sense of faith. Sorry for non-South Africans watching on YouTube. And then, so that is not the kind of faith that I have in my rationality. The kind of faith I have in my rationality is the kind of faith he has in mathematical certainty when he does proofs of mathematical theorisms, where I subject claims, either if they are observable claims, to verification, falsification, or in the event where we're talking about values-based conversations, which we're moving to next, then of course they need to be subjected to the criteria for sound argumentation. What are your premises? Do they support your conclusion? Do they do so sufficiently? If it's not that kind of argument, if it's based on inference to the best explanation, is it really the best explanation? Are you not taking on too much? There are some pretty clear criteria, independent of mystique about my brain being amazing, independent of that, that I can use as yardsticks for making sense of claims about the universe. That is not faith. That is a methodology that John himself is deeply committed to as a mathematician and as a scientist. So to describe that as faith on the part of the rationalist is, to put it mildly, I think, to use the word faith in a way that is designed to pretend that it has the same meaning in that context as it does in the context of those believers who are not like John, who are happy to believe in God on the basis of faith and don't care for apologetics. That person who uses faith in that context has a kind of faith that is very different to the rationality that you have so generously acknowledged that I'm displaying.
Can I comment on that?
No, well, I'm afraid we're going to have to move on, Professor John. We do need to move on. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, as you realize, same time next year, the extended version on the existence of God featuring Professor John Lennox and Eusebius McKaiser as they continue to engage. But surprisingly to me at the dinner table, this evening, I found out that both of them believe in the existence of objective moral values. Now, let me start with you again, Professor John. You believe in the existence of God. You believe in the existence of objective moral values. What is the connection between morality and God?
The connection between morality and God is that God is the ultimate ground of our being and therefore of our morality. Now, Eusebius and I both believe, we have faith in, and I simply think that you have fallen prey, sir, to the postmodern concept of faith, that it means believing where there's no evidence. I regard my trust in God and rationality as both evidence-based, and you've just given the reason for you, but we go into that another time. But let me come to this. You see, my connection between God and morality and reason and morality is not that I do not believe that there's a rational justification for morality at the level of argument that's independent of belief in God. Now, that I think we need to be very clear about, because you got that wrong in your newspaper article that you wrote about me before you talked to me, because you said you disagreed with me about this connection, and then you said you held an incompatible view that there's a rational justification for objective moral truth. I believe that as much as you do. That's what we call natural law. That's a very deep and important part of the thing. And interestingly enough, the Bible itself talks about nature, the natural world, teaching us things about morality. I agree with you on that. And in fact, reading through your thesis, I found myself in tremendous agreement with a lot of the arguments. I said, this is marvelous. Here's a fascinating character who claims to be an agnostic or an atheist, and he's giving me a lot more reasons for believing in absolute moral values. So, building on that, it seems to me the connection, Eusebius, is simply this. For me, it's not either or. It's not God or reasons for objective morality. It's that God gives me the reason for believing in objective morality. So I connect the first part of our discussion with the second. You trust your rationality correctly to give you moral values. I trust God to give me the rationality that gives me the moral values. Great. Because if you believe there's natural law, I would say you've got to believe in God to get nature in the first place. That's where the deep connection is.
I hope that was the clapping of the atheist listening very carefully to a fatal concession that John made there. Otherwise, you weren't listening very carefully. I am a moral objectivist. I do not believe that in order for me to explain to you why rape is morally wrong, I have to make reference to God. I do not believe that. And the key question is, can you privately give yourself an explanation for why rape is wrong without reference to the Christian God? There was a timed grammatical pause. And that is the basic view that I wanted to bring to the framing question tonight. Is God necessary at the level of justification for understanding the wrongness of the rightness of a particular moral fact? Now, John was delighted that both him and I think there are such things as moral facts. I'm not a relativist. I think it's one of the biggest dangers sociologically in the world right now. But I think John was, if not puzzled, he's very well read, may have come across people like an Immanuel Kant, who can give you an account of the categorical imperative without necessarily having to refer to a deity, let alone the Christian God. Now, there are two parts here to the discussion. And I concede in the spirit of the wonderful, honest rapport that we're having, that there is a difficulty for people like myself in philosophy, in academic philosophy, especially when we speak to non-philosophers. It's really difficult to give you a simple, straightforward, in plain English, an account of moral objectivity, because we all use moral language in everyday discourse, on radio, on Facebook, on Twitter, and we all think we're experts at ethics. We don't need to go and study moral philosophy. So I'm going to put it very simply, because this part of my burden is in the heart of the framing question, which is whether God is necessary. For me, it's very simple that I can look at the world. John was referring to sociological facts about human being that are fascinating commonalities, and I agree with him. That is the kind of ingredient that I use as a philosopher from which to build an account of the rightness and wrongness, the desirability, undesirability of certain kinds of behavior between human beings. In general, none of us like pain. In general, we like happiness. Happiness is too simplistic in philosophy. We might change it to other concepts so that it doesn't reduce to just hedonism or pleasure. But we kind of know human psychology. We know the kinds of things that make human beings more rather than less content. We use that, we add to it a couple of basic principles like a commitment to consistency in your reasoning and not being happy with arbitrary justifications. And then it really will take us no more than 10 minutes if we spend the time on it to make a link between that methodology for arriving at moral facts and understanding why the Constitution has the right to equality in it. It's also the reason why I abandoned law, because it's not interested in exploring more fundamental questions about the moral justification for why the right exists. But in cashing out that right, which is the main thing I used in my master's thesis, it is quite easy with a mixture of basic commitment to consistency in reasoning, plus facts about human psychology, and we can make a lot of progress in moral dialogue without reference to God. I'm going to park that. What I will acknowledge there, especially for any professional philosophers, that there's a lot of hard work to be done there. But the question that is the framing question for tonight's discussion, there I'm afraid, I really think that John has the more difficult side, because he has to tell me not just that he regards God as the source of his rationality, which in turn allows him to account for why rape is wrong. All he is saying there is that mechanistically or descriptively, God features in a story of how he came to have the ability to reason for himself that murder is wrong. What he didn't say there, which is the concession I was referring to that you might have missed if you were applauding affirmatively, is that by saying there's no deep difference between us, there is. Because God can be eliminated as not necessary for the justification to fall or stand of why murder is wrong. The most that God is needed for in John's life is as a medium to access what can be independently described as right or wrong.
All right. Thank you so much. Eusebius, let me, before you respond, John, I just do need to ask a question just so that we bring it down again. Are we using objective, the phrase objective moral values, in a sense that there's a moral, say, prescriptions that are free from human opinion, so they would be true even if no one in the room believed them to be so? Are we using it in that sense or a different sense?
Look, for purposes of this discussion, I think we can be fairly generous, whether you want to talk about moral facts, moral objectivity, universal moral principles. I mean, John and I can broadly agree, any of that language can do. The important thing is, John and I both think it's not up to you to say as a matter of, I feel it's okay to rape a baby to make it morally permissible. Him and I share the view that certain rules, it is morally wrong to rape a baby, is a rule whose truth and whose command power over you as a member of the moral community stands regardless of your personal sentiment. That is what I mean by objectivity, and that's what John means. Where we depart is that I don't think I need to make reference to the Christian God in giving you an account of why that rule is a rule you should comply with.
Thank you.
John. It's very interesting because the difference is small and it's great at the same time. You see, you said all that John can say is you need God to give an account of your rationality. But your total faith is in your rationality. If you didn't have it, we wouldn't be having this discussion. So bringing God in at that level is not all I can say. It's utterly necessary to the discussion. That's point number one. Point number two is, of course, we can give an argument that rape is wrong, just using reason, without mentioning God. But that's a very different thing. We're working in a world that was created by God. And the very reason we've come to that conclusion, I believe, is because we're made in the image of God. But now, if I go to go a little bit deeper, and you've challenged me to, I think there is a problem. You said, look, we can all see that human flourishing has a value. We can't all see that. Now, if I'm a Hitler, And I decide that flourishing for me is to get rid of the Jewish population. What are you going to say to me? And what are you going to ground the values? Well, what have you to say to me? I'd be very interested in that. Because what the God, bringing God into it, which from my mind is intellectually absolutely necessary, otherwise it leaves your faith and your rationality is ultimately blind. It has no grounding, so it is blind faith of the kind you don't like. That the God dimension is grounding that rationality and morality in a transcendent direction. And one of the things I noticed, and I'd love to hear your comment on it, Eusebius, what I notice is this. In the West, for centuries, there has been a God dimension to morality. Now, there is an utter desperation on the part of many philosophers and scientists. They've got rid of the vertical. So you try to get morality from in this world. Now, you are quite an exception, and I'm delighted, actually delighted you're such an exception, because many of the people I meet are desperate to ground morality in genetics or something like that, you see. And of course they get in a mess because Darwin looks at ants, there's altruism. Spencer sees the struggle for the survival of the fittest. And we all know where that has gone historically applied morally. So my problem is, if you simply say, it's my reason that tells me that, how do we deal with the extremes in this world, the Hitlers in this world, the ISIS of this world, going around beheading people? I'm just asking you that as a matter of interest. I don't think it's an easy question.
No, it's not, but I do have some responses. I've thought about it a lot. So let me say a couple of things. Firstly, on the idea of the relevant sense in which God is inextricably bound up with an account of why rape is wrong, is that without the generous rationality that he confers on John Lennox or Eusebius MacIsaac, you'd not be able to come to that conclusion yourself. I think John is making I don't mean this as a swipe against you, I mean it as an intellectual claim, is making a fairly elementary error there, which is that even if I grant you the existence of the Christian God, including the fact that he confers on both you and me the rationality capacity that in turn enables us to reason. And if he didn't, so I'll even grant you this, I'm a very generous agnostic, that if God didn't exist, which would be a nightmare for us, that we may not have the rationality to be able to come to the conclusion that raping a baby is wrong. So I'm giving you all of that. But the elementary mistake you're making there, John, is the following. It's the equivalent of saying, and I really mean this analogy, that my mom, bless her soul if she's in heaven, she was a believer, that my mom is inextricably bound up with my rationality. Because had she not given birth to me, God forbid, I wouldn't exist. And in turn, I wouldn't exist with the capacities to be able to reason about philosophy, normative questions, etc. Well, my mom might have a role in the story of how I came about. That is not the sense in philosophy in which she is needed to describe on paper why murder is wrong. If I said to John, I'm forcing you as homework to write me a 500-word essay without reference to God, why equality as a value matters, why murder is wrong, why female genital mutilation is wrong, he will pull it off. He knows he will. So the contingent account of God being generous enough to have given him the ability to write the essay is interesting at the level of knowing where his reasoning capacity comes from. It does absolutely no work epistemically, because the moral facts that he will write those essays about, he'll be able to give an account of without a reference to God. Allow me one more response, John, to your question about Hitler. I don't think it's actually a difficult question. The reality is that there are limits to who I can engage, you can engage as a Christian philosopher, and there are limits to who I can engage as a moral objectivist who is not a theist. If you don't identify as a member of the moral community, as it were, if you were a psychopath, if you were a sociopath, for example, then of course I can't reason with you. So there are limits to what I can say to a Hitler. But now ask yourself, does the fact that I cannot persuade Hitler that he is wrong in his moral reasoning, does it follow from that that I have to appeal to God? What are the chances of that succeeding? I'm not sure they're any greater. So very little follows from examples of evil in the history of the universe. Because the questions, and again, this is where I really look forward to meeting John, because we share this view about the limits of evolutionary theories that try and explain morality. Evolution can't force us to not ask questions, how should we behave? At best, they can describe how we actually have behaved. And that's why I think it doesn't get us very far in moral reasoning. But citing me a shopping list of example of people who are evil, and I can do the same about people who are Christian, is utterly not salient in the context of this debate, because my inability to make progress in getting Hitler to not continue with extermination is not evidence that there's an intimate connection between God and morality.
Well, let me respond then to that. Firstly, I thought of the analogy of your mother too, and I was going to use it. Because that is precisely the point I'm making. You said it does no epistemic work. It does epistemic work before the discussion starts. And I'm not disagreeing with you, Eusebius, that we can't write a 500-word essay giving reasons. I'm not disagreeing with that in the slightest. But where I might disagree, and I'm not sure I want to go down this road because it's a huge debate, I think there may be a fallacy in your logic, though, that you're doing what David Hume said you mustn't do, and that is you're going from is to ought. And as I look at that, I see that as a massive problem. You are arguing that ultimately you can get morality from your observation of facts. So you're moving from facts to values. And I disagree with David Hume about many things. But it seems to me he's got something very important there. How do you move from facts? You could say that to values. You can observe effects, but you've got to do the bridge. And as you know, there are many philosophers, like James Rachels, for example, whom you quote quite frequently, who realizes there's a massive difficulty. Now, it seems to me that the fact-value distinction is very much like the non-rational-rational distinction. I don't think you get from one to the other without an input of intelligence from outside, from God. So that's the first point I would make. Now, I mentioned Hitler rather awkwardly, and I apologize for that. What I'm really getting at beneath it is this. You believe in moral absolutes. Do you believe in ultimate justice? You see, from where I sit as a Christian, one of the great problems I get as I move around the world is facing people who are screaming for justice and never will get it. And if you look at the vast majority of people in this world, they don't get justice in this life, however much we fight for it. And if there's no judgment by a rational, loving God, they'll never get justice. And the thing I want to say is, whether Hitler believes it or not, or the ISIS people believe it or not, I think the fundamental teaching of Christianity that there's going to be ultimate justice is the thing that validates our conscience. And therefore, we have hope, or at least I have hope, to bring to people who are in a situation, and I often meet it, that they will never get justice. And the ironic thing to my mind is that atheism here, and I know you agree with me about atheists, but here the atheist position removes all hope of ultimate justice. We fight for justice in this life, that's wonderful. So let me rephrase that question. You believe in moral absolutes, yet you don't believe in I notice you use moral facts as distinct from natural law, and I suspect that's deliberate, because using the term natural law means that you believe that there's a lawgiver. I believe there's a lawgiver who will ultimately be a judge. Now, that dimension is totally missing, is it, from your worldview?
One thing, can I have 1 minute before we engage?
Of course. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. No, you have more than 1 minute just to...
Okay, yeah. So a couple of responses. Hume is one of my favorite philosophers. Fell in love with him in first year and remain in love with Hume. You are totally right, of course, that there's something dodgy going from descriptions of how the world worked to saying that that's how it ought to be. That's not what I did. So while I accept your description of what Hume is warning us against, that is not what I said at all. What I'm very happy to say, I don't have perfectly worked out. And if I had to return to the academy full time, I would spend work on this area in moral philosophy. Is making more sense. And that external examiner from UKZN that gave me a distinction, bless his soul, I think might have overlooked some weaknesses here that I'm happy to acknowledge in my MA thesis. That it's very difficult to give a really good account. And if any of you can, if you are budding philosophers, please do help me out. So I'll go back and plug the holes in my thesis. Of how we get from descriptions of what people like and don't like, pain, pleasure, etc., to saying things like, everyone is entitled normatively to equality. So I take that point completely. It's not what I was suggesting. I did my best as a young philosophy student to try and make that connection, drawing on others who've written about it. So I deny the accusation. What I was trying to do there, John, is not quite accusing you of the same thing, but I was trying to point out a structure of some of your arguments that is a pattern in the way in which you engage on these topics that I've now noticed. You are the one, ironically, that relies a lot on lived experience, descriptions of history, sociology, contingent facts about the world, and then a couple of minutes later, crank out God's existence. That is actually a much better case study, if I was a lecturer, of how someone goes from descriptions of the world they've lived in, descriptions of their personal experience, and then cranking out a massive conclusion. The Christian God exists with attributes that are not actually attributes that we routinely see in the world around us. I think you've got a bigger problem there. What? The other point that I wanted to make just on this is that of course, the fact that I might have difficulties as a non-theistic philosopher trying to come up with an account of moral facts that don't make reference to God, it doesn't follow from the shortcomings of my project, the struggle of that project, that you're on stronger turf. No way. You still have a hell of a lot more work to do. And you haven't done that work here today. Because what you need to tell me is why the kind of problem that an atheist philosopher who believes in moral objectivity faces, going from descriptions of human psychology to claims about how you ought to behave, you need to tell me what the argument is for gratuitously inserting the Christian God as a solution is justified. And you never do that work. I find you at that point a little bit assertive in the sense that it's almost saying if the Christian God existed and the Christian God had the following attributes, then these problems in moral objectivity for the atheist moral objectivist would fall away. But that is like saying you should therefore commit to the role of the Christian God in moral objectivity because it plugs certain discomforts intellectually that you are saddled with when you are trying to explain to Hitler why it's objectively wrong to kill Jewish people. But you haven't made the argument. You've just said, if God had these attributes, God would be a solution. But I've yet to have the argument for that. There was a final point that I want to make, but it just eludes me currently, so I'll stop there.
What we'll do, thank you so much, Eusebius. What I do want to do is engage the audience a little bit in on the discussion. Remember, you can take a moment now, please, if you have a question, to send through the hashtag CapW for Vitz for your questions. There's some questions already that have come through, starting with you. Professor John Lennox, is it only atheism that undermines science or anything non-Christian? Does Islam undermine science also?
Well, I would not regard myself as an expert on that, though my colleagues would point out that when it came to the transmission of Greek science in the Middle Ages and so on, the scholars working at the House of Wisdom in Baghdad made enormous contributions to doing that. And again, I'm not an expert. It would be correct for a Muslim scholar to answer this question. But there tend to be, as far as I can see, two strands within Islam on this. Those who are not so favorable towards scientific investigation and others who are. But since that's exhausted my knowledge, I'll stop. Perhaps Eusebius knows more about it than I do.
I haven't a clue. I'm agnostic on the matter.
So am I, really. That's
Eusebius, a question for you. What type of evidence would convince you of the existence of God?
It's a very good question. I'm not entirely sure. What I do know is that routinely in everyday life, and it gave me an opportunity to expand on a couple of things. This is also, by the way, where some fascinating disagreement happens between me and some of my atheist friends that I deeply respect intellectually. Let me be clear, and I do care about probability maybe a little bit more than John. Very few of us only have beliefs that are based on absolute certainty of the truth of those beliefs. Mm-hmm. So we do reason probabilistic oftentimes, and then end up believing claims to be true and acting as if they are certainly true, even if, theoretically speaking, we probably, if pushed in the seminar, agree that we don't know them with certainty. So certainty is not everything in life. In fact, I think a human life would be unrecognizable if you only wanted to believe things with certainty. So I accept that. And that's often where my atheist friends think they are close to converting me to atheism, because they say, aha, if you look at the probabilities of whether God exists or not, clearly the case for atheism is stronger than theism, so can you kindly make a jump from being an agnostic to being an atheist? Now, I'm setting all of that up by way of saying that I'm not sure what will convince me, but in my everyday experiences, I know that if we were to take a scientific examination of the contents of this bottle, there's a very good chance that we'll confirm it's H2O. Right? And I want a piece of evidence of a similar vein that is consistent with the methods that I use for why I have faith that in the event that I should have full-blown AIDS, say for example, that ARVs might actually help. I have faith in that because scientists subjected that to all sorts of processes, observing, testing, etc. So that's the kind of experience I probably have. What I thought John would do, but it's not the basis of his account, it seems, at least not singularly, of why he believes in God, is that I often get, the kind of evidence I'm often given is personal acquaintance with God, like an apparition, the experience of a miracle. That kind of experience wouldn't satisfy me, because you have to be able to eliminate potential explanations for those experiences that are consistent with more verified facts in science. So for example, if I have to ask you, why is there a greater chance of a God with these attributes that are queer to us, accounting for your experience last night when you saw something, than the possibility of just being mistaken, or having hallucinated, or you drank too much in Melville when you went clubbing? You need to be able to eliminate that. And so I'm never going to be satisfied with miracles, very unlikely. The idea of a personal experience that is not open to verification and testing by others, that is just personal knowledge, I find very odd. So I probably want the kind of evidence that John would give me if I asked him to prove to me and give me a good scientific account of why ARVs are effective and I should take them if I was an AIDS patient. That is the level of justification I'm looking for.
John, would you like to respond? Is one of your next questions was about the evidence that you've given today. Would you like to respond to that?
Well, I actually reject the idea that I've simply made assertions. You made a lot of assertions, and you've accused me of making assertions, that I'm simply taking in contingent facts from sociology. I don't think I'm doing that at all. I could have unpacked, of course. And you mentioned probability, so let me come back to that. Many of my scientific colleagues, some who are not even Christian, when it comes to the observable fine-tuning of the universe, they think something is going on. And a lot of scientific work has been done through the past 50 years. And you get somebody like Roger Penrose, one of my colleagues, who says, you know, to get a universe like this one, with the second law of thermodynamics, the creator's aim, and those are his words, and he's a humanist, has to be accurate to one part in 10 to the 10 to the 123. Now, what interests me is not my reaction to that, but the reaction to high-powered scientists For instance, Arno Penzias, who got the Nobel Prize for the microwave background, and he says, here we have a universe that's so finely tuned, its basic constants so precisely tuned, that we could say, almost say, it has been designed to a supernatural plan. Now, that's just not asserting contingent facts, Eusebius. That's a reaction to how science has developed. And I would say that the history, which you think contingent facts of history, but the connection between modern science, the rise of modern science, and Christian belief is a fact we have to factor in. It didn't arise in Chinese society, which didn't have, as Joseph Needham saw, and he was a neo-Marxist, it didn't have the unifying principle of a creator. So I don't think I'm doing what you say, simply making assertions. And I mean, all I can do is assert back and let the people judge. Now, you mentioned miracles, finally, and David Hume. I interacted a bit with Anthony Flew on David Hume and his take on miracles. And Anthony Flew, as you may know, came to the conclusion that Hume was wrong and that he would have to rewrite all of his books. Now, we haven't time to do that. But I take so seriously your point that we have to, in order to believe something like the resurrection of Jesus and not be gullible for all kinds of things, we have to very powerful evidence. Because by definition, miracles are extremely improbable. But the point is this. I take your point so seriously that I've just published a book, actually, if you don't mind me mentioning it, Winston, called Gunning for God, where I devote the last two chapters, one to the in-principle argument against miracle. That is, miracle cannot happen because they violate the laws of nature, which I believe to be false. I think Hume was wrong there. He didn't even believe in the laws of nature because he didn't believe in cause and effect. But also, then looking at the resurrection of Jesus through Hume's criteria for witnesses. And I think that can be done, and I think it gives us very powerful criteria for basing an evidence-based faith in the resurrection of Christ. So I simply don't recognize your description of what I've been trying to say. But, of course, we'll disagree about that. I let the audience judge.
Can I have a 30 seconds response?
30 seconds, please.
I'm perfectly happy to not characterize you as being assertive. That's very rude. Perhaps a better description, which I think you may be happy with, that the nature of your argument is certainly one based on inference to the best explanation. But I do not accept it as a good inference. So I'm still not happy that it is sufficiently cogent. And the reason for it is, and in the interest of the 30 seconds that I claim, I'm going to be very quick here on this one, can engage anyone in the audience about it afterwards. All the brilliant and interesting work being done by many of the biologists that, John, that you're aware of on this fine-tuning question, quite frankly, I found that work always as a philosophy student to be sophisticated versions but not actual advancements on the watchmaker analogy from centuries ago. It is just a more sophisticated version of saying, if I come across a watch, there must be a watchmaker. If I see a universe that is finely tuned, I must infer that God exists. But there's a clear disanalogy because we know watchmakers exist. We've seen them do it. And there's a basis for suspecting if you come across a watch, there must be a watchmaker. You cannot do the same kind of reasoning in respect to the universe's beauty. And the scientists working on this field might give us a cooler description than the person who uses the watchmaker analogy, because they can then talk in scientific and biological detail about the incredible fine-tuning of the human being and the world that we live in. But at the end of the day, to go from there to making the inference an intelligent being exist, that inference is still hasty.
Thank you. Just some few quick questions I'm going to ask if you would be you just give some quick responses, because then I'm going to ask you to give some closing remarks in a little while. I know you'd like to hear more, but this is a good advert for next year's event. Eusebius, very quickly, how do you distinguish between right and wrong if you acknowledge that you cannot account for going from descriptive to normative?
Well, with great difficulty. And I'm not ashamed of that. It's one of the reasons why I'm an agnostic in the first place. If there are problems and challenges with intellectual projects, with personal projects, you live them. This is one thing I actually share with John. It's why I've really enjoyed getting to know you in a couple of hours. You live them. You wrestle with them. So this is me. I mean, put aside the intellectual part of the conversation. So I really have trouble with that. It would have been a big part of my work as an academic philosopher if I chose that life. I don't. I think it's really, really difficult to know how to fill in those details. I think some philosophers have succeeded. Kantian ethics fascinate me, for example. Kant is an objectivist. I find the categorical imperative a pretty good principle that guides my action as a matter of fact when I think about right and wrong. But the short answer to that question is that I don't have something that I can pull out of a hat. And I'm very comfortable with that. What I'm not going to do is solve my discomfort and the project that is ongoing personally and intellectually by taking a leap into the arms of a Christian God.
Thank you. John, is the contradiction between evolution and the biblical creation story not a good example of the contradiction between science and religion?
How long have you got?
1 minute.
This is a massive question. Let me put it this way. It depends which evolutionary count you're thinking about, because we tend to be confused about evolution. We use it to cover a whole lot of things. Unfortunately, part of the confusion is due to Richard Dawkins, if I dare mention him again. It is blind watchmaker. He said evolution accounts for the existence and variation of life. He's withdrawn that. Evolution has nothing to do with the existence of life, because you don't have evolution in any sense going until you have life, so you can leave that out. Secondly, there are two issues. First of all, as far as theism goes, I do not think you can deduce the non-existence of a creator on the basis of discovering a mechanism that does something. And that simply means that you cannot deduce, and you could see that categorically, that you can't deduce a worldview from biology. They don't even fit in the same categories. But secondly, the much more provocative question is whether the current theories of natural selection and genetic drift and so on, mutation, can bear the weight put on them. I'm not a biologist, but I read a lot of the stuff, and I'm fascinated what's coming out. I just mentioned one person, James Shapiro, head of molecular biology in Chicago, who's just written a fascinating book, Evolution from a 21st Century Viewpoint. And he says that the idea that we get improvements in complexity of life by numerous small accumulations is simply false. And the thing that I'm observing as a non-biologist is what is being queried is the adequacy of this putative mechanism to do any more than Darwin observed. He brilliantly observed that you can get finch beak legs changing and so on, but getting elephants from protozoa is a different matter altogether. Now, as a wearing my mathematical hat, it seems to me there's a major theoretical problem looming. Nagel is bringing one to attention and saying this reductionist view won't do because it won't cope with mind. The second problem is this, that all computer scientists know junk in, junk out. And if you regard the living cell as an information processor, which it is at least, then you come up against things like the Church Turing thesis, that a Turing machine, that is any computer at all, past, present, or future, cannot generate any information that's not either in its input or in its own informational structure. That seems to me to be threatening the whole naturalism project. So it seems to me the judgment is out. Now you mentioned the biblical view. The biblical view is fascinating because what it says is, in simple but utterly profound language, now you'd want me to justify this, and to do that I've written another book about it, but they'll find that out on the internet. The point is this, we have lived to the science, the information age. We've discovered that information is a fundamental non-material quantity that's not reducible to physics and chemistry. That banishes materialism to me forever. But secondly, that what we've got in the biblical simple description, which is another reason that I believe it as a scientist, the focal point of the Bible when it comes to the origin of the universe is, and God said, and God said, and God said, updated to the New Testament. In the beginning was the Word. All things came to be through him. So when I approach that and read it, I say this is absolutely brilliant in that sense. It focuses on the fact that the whole creation was built up stepwise, and the universe, peace be to Hume, although I'm not sure that he believed this, the universe is not a closed system of cause and effect, and that God fed in information and energy at stages. That's the exact opposite of a mindless, unguided process.
Thank you so much, Professor John. I think in the interest of our minds tonight, I'm going to have to ask Eusebius for your closing four-minute remarks, and as well as you, John, afterwards.
I thought Winston was neutral. I would have preferred the word brain. Three final sets of thoughts by way of closing. I mean, the first is that I hope you've followed, even if you agree or disagree, but at least followed and enjoyed some of the exchange between me and John. But to reiterate where I'm coming from overall, whether it be the views about God's existence, connection between God and morality, or a question we didn't touch on today that I want to briefly talk about in my second summation point, questions around meaning, the meaning of life, is that I am profoundly committed, don't always get it right, and I don't desire to get it right, otherwise I'd be a really boring person, but in general, I'm fascinated by whether or not I'm justified to believe anything. And thus far in my life, I've not yet been convinced that there is overwhelming evidence of God's existence, and most of the kinds of arguments I've come across are based on analogies, on inferences, or simply the functional value that a belief in God might have in my life that may be positive, none of which I deny. In fact, I sometimes offer it as a sweetener to some of my Christian friends and say, in response for acknowledging that your belief is unjustified, why don't we agree it's okay to sometimes believe things if they have a functional value in your life? We all do it. Some of us believe in the gospel of the ANC without evidence. So that's the first point I want to make, and I think John and I at least share that commitment to evidence. The second point I want to make, it's not a summation point, I just want to sneak in a thought that earlier had escaped my old mind, is if God is not in your moral reasoning, it doesn't follow that you lack hope. I do not know what the concept of ultimate justice means. I think John and I would have to tease that out on another occasion. Maybe on my radio show, John. I don't know what ultimate justice means. But more importantly, a gripe that I have, a friendly gripe intellectually, is the idea that if you're an atheist or an agnostic and you don't believe in God, you couldn't possibly, and John doesn't believe this, but many Christians do, sadly. You can't have deep empathy, you can't have a sense of hope, a sense of yearning. You can't hug that person whose shack has just burned down and has lost a family member, and someone who's struggling against the state, fighting the police for an illegal arrest, or justice for the Marikana workers, the families, people who were killed. You can't have that if you don't have God. It's a profound lie. If you look at the lives of people that you admire, including the ones who are Christian, a lot of what they do isn't intimately connected, the good virtues that they display, to even their belief in God. But the more limited point I want to make is that, of course, an atheistic life is not hollow inside. We may not believe in things like souls. Only some of us must talk about minds. But it certainly doesn't follow that concepts like love, hope, and empathy are something that Christians have a monopoly on. And then the last thing I want to say, which is the reason why I accepted to come to this debate, is that I really hope that you will appreciate, I think, one thing that doesn't exist enough in South Africa, which is public debate. It's very different to being on radio, different to a lecture, and of course it's different to something John and I agreed a little bit earlier as we walked in. It's dull, even if it has a place, which is the idea of a forum of 10 people, and you come and listen to them speak. I think we need more public debate, and I think that's important. And in addition to that, what I love about John is the commitment, and we can disagree on whether I think it's convincing or not, but we are both committed to an examined life, a critical life as an important part of a worthwhile life, and I certainly hope that that's one thing that you will share, that even if you are a Christian, that you should be unsatisfied with not being able to speak about your Christianity with some conviction.
Thank you very much. Professor Lennox.
Well, Eusebius, ladies and gentlemen, one thing I've come to the conclusion tonight is that Eusebius exists. And I've so enjoyed this discussion. I think this is a great example of the best and public-spirited, friendly discussion. Summing up very briefly, you're quite right just a moment or two ago to say that my arguments are reminiscent of Paley's. But I happen to think his argument about the watchmaker was brilliant. Not everything he said was brilliant. But you see, the interesting thing is, you say we know about watchmakers, we've no idea about the God, but half a minute, we've got watches in biology, absolutely brilliant timekeepers. And the point about inference to the best explanation is very simple. When I see evidence of design, particularly semiotic evidence, linguistic evidence in the structure of DNA, I would much prefer an explanation that made sense to one that doesn't. And the God explanation makes perfect sense to me, God who is the Word, as an ultimate explanation, whatever natural processes were involved in the Word that's in every one of the 10 trillion cells in our body. I think God has left his fingerprints all over the universe in that sense. So I prefer an explanation that makes sense. And when we see anything linguistic, like that word exit over there, even though it's only four letters, we infer an intelligent input, no matter how many automatic processes might have been involved in producing that sign. And I'm just saying the inference from DNA to an intelligence behind the universe is rational, while rejecting intelligence goes against every single analogy we know. That's point number one. Point number two is that I do believe you can verify the truth of Christianity. After all, the claim is not simply that there is a God. The claim is that God can be known and experienced. Now, of course, that's a startling claim. But what comes instantly to my mind, that when Jesus was here on earth, he said, if any man wills to do God's will, he shall know of the teaching, whether I am from God, speak from God, or speak from myself. So I've made that experiment. I think there's an experiment that one can make. I could say to you, there's a red Maserati sitting outside the door of this lecture theater. We could argue philosophically till the cows come home, as we say in Ireland, and I'd never prove it to you. You have to go and look. Now, I'm not suggesting you're not prepared to, but I'm a skeptic about many things, and so are you, obviously. Skeptine in Greek means to check from a distance. But if you want to get to know a person, if I'm ever going to get to know you, I've got to give up my distance, and so have you. And what I believe is the case here is that God has given up his distance as creator and become human. We are human, so we can get to know him. But we can only get to know him in the way we get to know other persons, by being prepared to give up our distance and to make the experiment of trusting him. Finally, this one comes. Finally, I agree utterly with Eusebius. It is a slander on atheists, agnostics, and everything else to say that they cannot show empathy. That disturbs me as much as it disturbs you. And ladies and gentlemen, you see, from where I sit, let me go even further. My atheist friends can sometimes put me to shame morally. If you look at the Bible, often pagans put the great patriarchs to shame. Why is that? Now, from where I sit, it's for a very simple reason with which I started. Every man and woman, whether they believe in God or not, is made in the image of God and is therefore infinitely valuable, and we need to be very careful how we treat each other. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, John. Now.
Cheers, John. Thank you.
Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, I would ask, I know that regardless of where you stand tonight on the position, I know that we've been led to engage, to examine our lives in terms of what we do believe, what we don't believe, and the reasons for that, what we think, what we don't think, and the reasons for that. But I would like you to, once again, please show your appreciation tonight for our speakers. Please, put your hands together as well. Please. Thank you, Eusebius, and thank you, Professor Lennox. With that, let's close our eyes. I'm joking. ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Please.